You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Colorado Springs Gazette, read by Raymond Wallander. This is being recorded on Friday, August 23rd, 2024. And today we will be reading the following main articles. Front page headlines, of course, local government and education issues, editorial materials, and following up with miscellaneous articles of local interest. The main headline this morning is Chart a New Way Forward as Harris Summons Americans to Reject Division. From Chicago, Vice President Kamala Harris called on Americans to join her to chart a new way forward as she accepted the Democratic nomination on Thursday, arguing her personal story and prosecutorial background made her uniquely qualified to protect their interest and beat Republican Donald Trump. Taking the stage to a thunderous standing ovation at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Harris sought to introduce herself to the American public and outline her vision for leading the nation for the next 4 years. Our nation with this election has a precious, fleeting opportunity to move past the bitterness, cynicism, and divisive battles of the past, Harris said. A chance to chart a new way forward, not as members of any one party or faction, but as Americans. Harris's address in Chicago caps a whirlwind 8 weeks in American politics and manifests the stunning reversal of Democratic fortunes just 75 days until Election Day. Party leaders who had publicly despaired over President Joe Biden's candidacy over his disastrous debate against Trump were jubilant both at the historic nature of Harris's candidacy and their buoyed hopes for this November. The daughter of Jamaican and Indian immigrants, Harris became the first black woman and person of South Asian descent to accept a major party's presidential nomination. If elected, she would become the first female U.S. president. America, the path that led me here in recent weeks was no doubt unexpected, but I'm no stranger to unlikely journeys, she said. Harris talked about being raised primarily by her mother after her parents divorced in a small apartment in San Francisco's East Bay, and being raised as well by friends and caregivers who were family by love. She also detailed a key part of her political origin story when Wanda, her best friend from high school, confided in her that she was being abused by her stepfather and came to live with Harris's family. That is one of the reasons I became a prosecutor, to protect people like Wanda, Harris said. Outlining her career as a prosecutor, state attorney general, senator, and now vice president, Harris said, "My entire career, I've only had one client, the people." Meanwhile, she said Trump has only ever acted in the interest of the only client he has ever had, himself. As she took the stage, she saw a sea of female delegates and Democratic supporters wearing white, the color of women's suffrage, the movement that culminated with American women securing the right to vote in 1920. A festive mood filled the United Center all evening, with a packed audience including running mate Tim Walz, dancing and singing along to a mix of pop and classic rock. Two of Harris' young grandnieces were brought on stage by actress Kerry Washington to remind the convention how to correctly pronounce her first name. At the girls' direction, one side of the arena shouted, "Comma," and the other, "Law." Harris made a recent appeal to anti-Trump Republicans to put aside party labels and to support her over Trump, who denied his loss to Biden in the 2020 election, which inspired the January 6, 2021 riot. I know there are people of various political views watching tonight, and I want you to know I promise to be a president for all Americans, Harris said. I promise to be a president for all Americans to hold sacred America's constitutional principles, fundamental principles, from the rule of law and fair elections to the peaceful transfer of power. The prosecutor in Harris surfaced during the speech when, in referring to Donald Trump, she referred several times to his explicit intent to free those who assaulted law enforcement officers at the Capitol, jail political opponents, and use the military against American citizens. Consider what he intends to do if we give him the power again, she added. Among others who spoke before Harris on Thursday were Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, Gabby Giffords, the Arizona Democrat who was nearly killed in a mass shooting in 2011, and civil rights leader Al Sharpton. Sharpton highlighted the historic nature of Harris' nomination, noting that 52 years ago he was a youth director for former Representative Shirley Chisholm's 1972 Democratic primary bid for the White House. Chisholm, who was black, died in 2005. But Sharpton drew cheers when he declared, "I know she's watching us tonight as a black woman stands up to accept the nomination for President of the United States." Sharpton also introduced the now exonerated members of the Central Park Five, the black teenagers who were wrongly convicted of rape in New York City in 1989. Trump took out full-page newspaper ads at the time calling for them to receive the death penalty, and even today sidesteps calls to apologize. Republicans, meanwhile, have raced to define Harris, accusing her of being a communist and dangerously liberal. Trump also targeted her race, while his running mate, J.D. Vance, describes her as a chameleon. Moving to the local news, student attendance absenteeism rates continue to improve, as Eric Young tells us. One of the larger hindrances of public education after the COVID-19 pandemic was a dramatic rise in chronic student absenteeism. However, new state data released Thursday indicates schools are continuing to recover from this. According to the Colorado Department of Education, student attendance increased by 7/10 percentage points up from to 91.5%, while chronic absenteeism decreased by 3.4 percentage points to 27.7% in the 2023-2024 school year. Both figures reflect continued trends from the previous school year, with attendance rising and absenteeism dropping. A state-high rate of chronic absenteeism was recorded at 35.5% during the 2021-2022 school year. We know that our educators and school leaders are working urgently to keep students engaged and feeling connected to their actual communities, and we see that effort reflected in attendance and chronic absentee rates, Colorado Education Commissioner Susanna Cordova said in a statement regarding the data. If students aren't in school, we know they won't have access to the opportunities designed to help them continue learning. Chronic absenteeism is defined by the CDE as students missing at least 10% of the school year. Across the nation, about 1 in 4 students were chronically absent during the 2022-23 school year. Despite the positive trends, statewide attendance has yet to reach pre-COVID marks. In 2019-20, the state average for attendance was 92.8%, and the average chronic absentee rate was 22.6%. This year, more than 241,000 of the state's 902,854 students were chronically absent. The trend of missing significant school time coincides with declining test scores during the same years, contributing to substantial learning losses and greater high school dropout rates. And we have found that even missing a couple of days here and there can cause problems, Cordova said. In the early grades, Multiple absences can cause students to fall behind on their reading skills. And in fact, 83% of chronically absent kids are not reading on grade level by third grade. Factors contributing to chronic absenteeism beyond the pandemic include students experiencing homelessness, transportation challenges, disengagement, and personal and family illnesses. So, some of those who we have seen increase over time, even if they're not necessarily new ones, said Johan Lellengreen, CDE Director of Dropout Prevention and Student Reengagement. State data also revealed rates of chronic absenteeism continuing to decline and attendance to rise for unhoused, migrant, special needs, and multilingual students, along with students of color and those who were economically disadvantaged. Nearly 70% of Colorado's districts improved their attendance rates last year. The districts with the highest reported rates of chronic absenteeism last year included Adams County 14, 48.9%, Centennial R1, 53.5%, Hanover 28, 46.6%, and Ouray R1, 60.5%. The Centennial Board of Cooperative Educational Services reported the highest rate of chronic absenteeism at 80.8%. This week, the CDE also released its statewide testing results that revealed promising signs of COVID recovery, though not at high school levels. To help promote attendance in school and continue to these positive trajectories, the CDE announced the Every School Day Matters campaign. Its goal is to support students, families, and educators in reducing chronic absenteeism to 17.8% by the 2026-27 school year. The online portal will include training and resources for educators and school leaders, communications tools for districts, and an attendance tracking calendar in English and Spanish for families. What data tells us, what the research has found, and what common sense shows is that you can't grow academically if you're not in school, Cordova said. The campaign's resources, along with complete attendance data, can be found at the CDE's website. Well, the local level for sports, TCA, the Classical Academy, is to dive in first as girls' flag football kicks off. Brent Brigham brings us the story. Claire Moore spent Wednesday night creating flashcards and cramming as if for a final. Actually, this is only the beginning. And those flashcards? They were filled with patterns and formations for a sport that Moore and many of her teammates on the Classical Academy's trailblazing flag football team never thought they'd receive an opportunity to experience. It's been stressful, honestly, to learn all these plays in a short amount of time, said Moore, one of four senior captains for a Titan squad that will open the season Friday against Thunder Ridge, the first game for a Pikes Peak region team in this inaugural season of flag football as a sanctioned Colorado High School Activities Association, CHASA, sport. I really don't know anything, to be honest. Moore, a sprinter in track, found her way to flag football as a matter of curiosity and as an escape from the distance running rigors of cross country. For Lillian Groth and Abby Snyder, this was the full-time fulfillment of a wish they never even considered making. Groth loves college football and carries an encyclopedic knowledge of its players and stats. It is a sport around which she bonds with her father and something she frequently plays with her younger brothers. Boomer Sooner, the Oklahoma fan added emphatically. I was out of town and one of my friends texted me and said, "Oh my gosh, there's a flag football team," Groth said. I was like, "Sign me up. I'm out of town, but you can write my name on the list. Please do." Snyder grew up watching her older brother, Josh, play football and endured long summers of tackle football with him in the backyard. She always wanted to play football, even calling it a dream, but she never saw a realistic scenario where that could happen. She took up volleyball and made that her lone sport. Because the sports run concurrently now in the fall, she had to choose one. When I heard they were starting flag football, I was like, oh my goodness, I need to do this. This is perfect, Snyder said. It's the perfect opportunity, the perfect way to close my senior year, finish my chapter with TCA. I just said, I want to go all in with this. Kate Osborne was also intrigued from the start, jumping at the chance to set the foundation for a new program and a new sport. I feel super lucky, Osborne said. I remember I was like, really? This is actually happening? I might get to play football? I signed my name so fast. TCA collected 77 emails on an initial interest sheet, roughly 25% of the girls in the school. They then had 57 girls come out for tryouts, from which they picked 17 for varsity and 19 for junior varsity. It's a group comprising participants who considered themselves soccer players, basketball players, runners, and more. It is neat for them to come from different communities, said Coach Frank Haste, who is uniquely qualified for the role as a former college football player who has coached basketball for 28 years, most of that coaching girls. The nice thing is we're all on level ground. It's not like a girl came from another school and had 2 years of flag football behind her. Everybody was new, and everybody was insecure. I told the girls, I'm insecure as a coach. We're all insecure together. It's all new for us. Let's just build confidence by preparing. I told them our theme this year is love and preparation are our separation. The mental side preparation has been intense, so it was fitting that half of the final preseason practice on Thursday was pushed into a classroom. Haste reviewed the offense, defense, and special teams and read the lineup for Friday's game for the first time. The questions from the players highlighted the extreme newness to all for some, as Haste at one point was asked to clarify what he meant by second string. I knew the fundamentals would be key, Haste said, of the overall approach to building the program from scratch. Just last week, we introduced schemes slowly. If our schemes aren't where they need to be, all good, but our girls can catch the ball, and we have girls who can throw the ball, and they can avoid flags, and they can get flags. I figured those were the main fundamentals, so we worked on that. We'll have the whole year to refine our schemes. The four senior captains who spoke to the Gazette expressed appreciation for the rare opportunity at hand. It's not often that a sport is introduced, providing a chance for players and programs to forge an identity. And while they don't yet know what to expect on the field, particularly in the opener against a 6A team that was a pilot program for 2 years, they have enjoyed what the process has brought. It's so stressful, but we're going to have so much fun, Snyder said. I love the team that we've built. It's such good camaraderie. All the girls are coming from different sports. I've never played a sport with these girls because it was always volleyball. So it's so fun to make new connections and grow new relationships because all of a sudden this new sport is introduced and we can all play it together. The opener for the Titans at 3 p.m. Friday. The area's other programs, Air Academy, CSCS, Coronado, Doherty, Ellicott, Vanguard, and Vista Ridge, several of which fielded pilot programs last year, will follow later in August. I'm so excited for tomorrow, Groth said. I cannot wait to get out there and play because, I mean, you obviously can only do so much to prepare and practice, and then you just kind of have to get thrown into the deep end and play a game. The investigation of the Morphew case continues as lawyers for 19 law enforcement officers make the case to dismiss the suit. Carol McKinley tells us, Lawyers for 19 law enforcement officers who worked on the arrest and failed prosecution of Barry Morphew on Wednesday made their various cases for dismissal of a lawsuit the widower filed against them in federal court. In May of 2023, Morphew sued key case investigators and prosecutors for allegedly violating his constitutional rights. In the complaint, he even sued the Chaffee County commissioners. 4 months later, Suzanne Morphew's remains were found, and an autopsy report discovered that chemicals used to tranquilize deer and other wild animals were found in the bone marrow of a femur. That discovery definitely changed the landscape, said Morphew's attorney, Hollis Whitson, in court Wednesday. At the motions hearing in Denver's Alfred A. Arruj Federal Courthouse, defense attorneys asked U.S. District Judge Daniel Domenico to apply absolute and qualified immunity and toss the case. Morphew's civil attorney, Iris Ayton, argued that prosecutors are not entitled to absolute immunity and called the circumstances egregious. But it wasn't the attorney's arguments that caught people's attention during the nearly three-hour motions hearing. Instead, it was comments made by the presiding judge. In questioning Morphew's attorneys, Judge Domenico stated several times that Barry Morphew is still being investigated for the alleged murder of his wife, Suzanne, who disappeared Mother's Day weekend 2020. It was a statement that appeared to catch Morphew's attorneys off guard, even though the case was dismissed without prejudice on the eve of trial in April 2022, meaning it could be brought back to court. Morphew walked out of the courthouse a free man and has maintained that he did not kill his wife. Domenico's statements that Morphew's civil attorney, Jane Fisher Byerlson, to take issue, noting that at the hearing's close, that new lead prosecutor, Ann Kelly, has told her in phone conversations that the Morphew investigation is a cold case. "This means there is no suspect," said Brierlson, addressing the judge. "I want to be very clear. You said Barry Morphew is under investigation. This is irrelevant and not true." When asked about Fisher Bioson's comments, Kelly told the Gazette via an email statement that the investigation into the remains of Suzanne Morphew is ongoing. The 12th Judicial District Attorney's Office is assisting with that investigation. As to the reference to the Morphew case as cold, she added that guidance from her office and the Colorado Department of Criminal Justice designated this ongoing investigation as a cold case. That phrase is specifically defined in the Colorado Victims' Rights Act. She added that the cold case designation is used narrowly by the investigation team to guide their decision-making around the release of information. The term cold case is referenced to case designations contained in the Victims' Rights Act. Indicates only that a criminal case is not currently pending, wrote Kelly. It is only the second time that Kelly has commented publicly on the renewed Morphew investigation since it was transferred from 11th Judicial District Attorney Linda Stanley. Barry Morphew, as his dead wife's next of kin, is her voice, even though he was arrested on suspicion of her murder in the now-dismissed case. Often, prosecutors must supply information to a victim's next of kin, even if the next of kin once was a suspect, explained former Denver District Attorney Craig Silverman. Bottom line is, all you have to do is let them know about the critical stages of a case. It's about keeping victims informed and able to participate, he said. Remember, though, the prosecutor does not work for the victim. The prosecutor works for the people. Well, recreational pot initiative is headed to the city ballot, as lawmakers hope to stop via compromise. Mary Shin tells us, Colorado Springs residents are likely to see a question asking them to legalize recreational marijuana sales on the November ballot. Responsible Rec for Colorado Springs, a local group that advocates the legalization of recreational marijuana sales, submitted about 3,400 petition signatures above the minimum needed to place question on the ballot that seeks voter approval, city officials said Thursday. The proposal would allow only existing medical marijuana shops to transition to selling recreational marijuana and dedicate revenue to funding public safety programs, mental health services, and post-traumatic stress disorder treatments programs. It's balanced. It is reasonable, said Tom Scudder, president of the Colorado Springs Cannabis Association, at a recent city council meeting. He said the question was designed to meet the needs of citizens. The citizens group submitted 28,000 signatures to make the ballot. The industry employs 1,500 to 2,000 people in town, he said, although that's declining as the industry matures and consolidates. The city council has the option Tuesday to either adopt the citizen initiative question as an ordinance or send it on to voters, spokesman Max Donofrio said. The council is likely to send it on to the voters because the board recently approved its question asking voters to ban recreational marijuana sales in the city charter. In the unlikely event that both questions passed, the charter amendment would take precedence. The dueling question sparked intense debate at the most recent council meeting, with advocates pointing out recreational marijuana is widely available and Colorado Springs simply doesn't benefit from it, while opponents highlighted the potential health risk of marijuana. Colorado was the first state to legalize recreational marijuana in 2012. The law allowed cities to decide whether recreational marijuana would be sold within their city limits. Colorado Springs is home to about 90 medical marijuana dispensaries. The community had 114 dispensaries in 2022, the last time voters were asked to legalize recreational marijuana sales in town. The question failed by a margin of 57% to 43%. Truman Bradley, the executive director of Marijuana Industry Group, told the council that 96 municipalities in the state allow recreational marijuana sales. At the same time, marijuana use among teens has dropped, he said. The Healthy Kids Colorado survey shows that the percentage of high school students who have used marijuana has fallen from 41% in 2009 to 26% in 2023. The survey does not include data from El Paso County because of lack of participation. Jack Briggs, president and CEO of the Springs Rescue Mission, was among those opposed to legalizing sales and noted that he rarely meets someone whose path to addiction did not start with marijuana. I have to clean up what happens when it goes bad, and that's what I see every day, he said. The marijuana industry in Colorado has gone through a prolonged downturn the last 2 years as marijuana tourism in the state has declined. 24 states and the District of Columbia allow recreational marijuana. A change in the 2018 Farm Bill also has given rise to the sale of THC products derived from hemp in states where recreational marijuana is not legal. You may contact the writer at mary.shin@gazette.com or at 719-429-9264 for more information regarding this article. Well, the Springs police conduct two homeless camp sweeps. Abby Sukup tells us that Colorado Springs Police Department's homeless outreach team reported more than a dozen arrests and citations this week in sweeping two local homeless encampments. At 12:48 p.m. Tuesday, HOT officers deployed near the area of Austin Bluffs Parkway and North Academy Boulevard after multiple complaints from nearby businesses of trespassing, camping, and other activity involving narcotics, officials said. According to the department, officers cited four individuals for trespassing and two for illegal camping. Police said they arrested six individuals and brought them to the Criminal Justice Center for outstanding warrants. Officers said they offered resource assistance to individuals experiencing homelessness contacted during the sweep. Hours later, at 5:45 p.m., the HOT team sent a second deployment of officers to the area of West Uinta and 19th Streets after a second series of trespassing, camping, parking, and narcotics activity complaints. Department officials have said outreach team officers issued two trespassing citations and notified others of outstanding misdemeanor warrants. One person was taken to the Criminal Justice Center on an outstanding warrant. Additionally, officers impounded one vehicle and one camper trailer and issued warnings for five vehicles in the area that could be towed if not moved in a reasonable amount of time. According to an online blotter entry, officers also returned to the area of West Uinta and 19th Streets Wednesday to finish the encampment sweep. During the Wednesday sweep, officers issued another 11 individual trespassing citations and one citation for urinating in public in a school parking lot. Three individuals were taken into custody on outstanding warrants. Well, Proposition 108 qualifies for the November ballot, as Marissa Ventrelli of ColoradoPolitics.com tells us. Just days before, the Colorado legislature is slated to hold a special session to pass a compromise and thereby stop Proposition 108. The Secretary of State's office announced it officially qualified for the November ballot. Proposition 108 aims to reduce assessment rates for residential and commercial properties to 5.7% and 24%, respectively. Last week, Governor Jared Polis announced he would be convening a three-day session on property taxes starting Monday. Polis said the goal is to pass a compromise on property taxes and pull from the ballot Proposition 108 and a proposed constitutional amendment, Proposition 50, which would cap future property tax growth at 4%. Advance Colorado and Colorado Concern, the groups behind the two initiatives, confirmed that a compromise has been reached between the governor and legislative leaders and that they will withdraw their initiatives from the ballot if the agreement is signed into law. Because the agreement offers a permanent solution to Colorado's property tax crisis, Advance Colorado and Colorado Concern will not bring similar ballot measures in the future, provided that the legislative, executive, or judicial branches do not go back on the provisions of the agreement in the years ahead, the group said in a news release. The agreement would cut the effective residential property tax to 6.3% or 6.4%, depending on assessment growth, and reduce the commercial property tax rate to 25%. It also caps growth for local governments at 5.25% and sets a limit for school districts at either 6% or inflation growth, whichever is higher. Additionally, it ensures that the ballot language for opting out of the local cap is clear and non-biased. Combined with legislation enacted this year, the deal yields nearly $1.6 billion in annual tax savings, according to Advance Colorado and Colorado Concern. Well, Colorado Democrats at the Democratic Convention, Negussie and Crow tout Harris and slam Trump. Ernest Looning of ColoradoPolitics.com tells us, U.S. Representatives Joe Negussie and Jason Crow touted Vice President Kamala Harris and derided former President Donald Trump, respectively, during the Colorado Democrats' brief remarks delivered Thursday night at the party's national convention in Chicago. The pair were among a cavalcade of current and former Democratic officials and activists who took the stage inside the packed United Center in the lead-up to Harris's speech accepting the nomination. My fellow Americans, let me say this clearly. Don't let anyone tell you that the American dream is dead, Negussie told the delegates after describing his immigrant parents' journey from war-torn Eritrea. It is alive and well, and it will grow even stronger with Kamala Harris as the next president of the United States. How do we know that? The goose said. It's because Kamala Harris believes that college can be a ticket to the middle class, and she has fought to make it more affordable for her entire career. Pointing to the Democratic presidential nominee's record as California's attorney general and as part of the Biden administration, Negus hailed Harris's commitment to making higher education achievable and affordable. Among the examples cited by Negus, he said, Harris led the charge to return $1 billion to students who were defrauded by for-profit colleges, helped expand student grants and funding for the nation's historic black colleges and universities, and helped put in place loan relief for teachers, first responders, and nurses. As president, she will build a brighter future, a more affordable future, a future where going to college doesn't break the bank, a future where my five-year-old daughter Natalie, who is watching us back home in Colorado right now, a future where she can live her dreams. Crow, a decorated Army Ranger veteran, took a more confrontational approach toward the prospects of another Trump presidency in his remarks. Like Colorado Governor Jared Polis, who addressed the convention Wednesday, Crow wielded an oversized copy of Project 2025, a document published by the Heritage Foundation for overhauling the federal government in a Republican administration, and sounded warnings about what could lie in store if Trump wins another term. Trump repeatedly has disavowed knowing anything about the roughly 900-plus page plan. The Associated Press reported that the initiative's contributors included numerous former aides and top advisors, and the website The Daily Wire reported this year that the project's team would be involved with Trump's transition effort. While Polis focused on what he characterized as limits on access to reproductive care, the book recommends that the federal government rescind approval of a drug commonly used to induce medical abortions, among other measures. Crow took aim at the book's national security directives. Over 100 combat missions in Iraq and Afghanistan taught me what really, really makes America strong and secure, Crow said. You see, it's not tough talk, it's not chest thumping, because in war, talk is cheap. And trust me, I know a couch commando when I see one. The quip, which drew laughter from the crowd, was an oblique jab at U.S. Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio, Trump's vice presidential running mate and a Marine veteran, who has been dogged since his nomination by claims involving fondness for couches. Turning serious, Crow gestured toward the giant bound volume in front of him and enumerated objections to its propositions. Real strength and security comes from our people, from our allies, Crow said. Donald Trump's Project 2025 would abandon our troops, abandon our veterans, our allies, and our principles. Crow said the plan describes an insular foreign policy that includes abandoning Ukraine and walking away from our NATO allies, which the Democrats said amounted to doing Russian President Vladimir Putin's bidding. Also in the plan, Crow said, is a proposal to move toward privatizing the administration of veterans' health care and steps to replace top career national security and military personnel with Trump loyalist. But I refuse to let Trump's golf buddies decide when and how our friends are sent to war, Crow said. Our troops deserve a commander-in-chief who will always have their back. That leader is Kamala Harris. Turning to the editorial page, the Gazette editorials board's opinion is entitled Work Regulations Kill Colorado Jobs. Few jurisdictions do more than Colorado to protect employees from employers. The overregulation of employer-employee relationships is costing jobs and future employment for people in desperation. when the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics this week revised employment numbers for the first quarter of 2024, it showed a downward revision of 818,000 fewer jobs nationwide than anticipated in the preliminary report. Colorado, far and away, led the other states in causing the downward revision. The revised report shows Colorado added 72,700 fewer jobs than were first reported. That number of ghost jobs exceeds one of every for every man, woman, and child living in Grand Junction, the largest city on the western slope. Colorado ranks as the 21st largest state in population, with 5.9 million residents. California, by contrast, has 39 million residents, Texas has 30 million, and Florida, 22 million. Despite our relatively small footprint, no other state comes close to matching our 72,700 negative jobs revision. The next closest state, Missouri, with a million more residents than Colorado, saw a revision of 54,200 fewer jobs. Thursday, the day the Gazette reported the sad new numbers, the editorial board received a presser from the left-wing organization Oxfam, which claims to fight poverty, injustice, and inequality. Oxfam marketers were eager to tell us that Colorado ranks eighth among the best states in which to work. This year, the District of Columbia earned the top spot in the index as the best state for workers, followed closely by California, number two, Oregon, three, New York, number four, and Washington, number five, the email declares. Oxfam chose Colorado and other winning states on a basis of 27 policies across three dimensions, wages, worker protections, and rights to organize, that seek to capture which states have stepped in to fill the gaps left by federal inaction to support low-wage workers and working families. Given Colorado's seemingly limitless desire to regulate employment, high minimum wage, generous family leave for almost any reason, new options to sue employers, etc., it is no surprise to see Colorado rank so high in Oxfam's view. Here's what Oxfam doesn't say. The list of best states could almost double as a ranking of places with the most people enduring unemployment, people with, who earn no wages. While Washington, D.C. tops the best places to work, it also tops all states and territories in unemployment with a rate of 5.5%. California, the second best place to work, has the country's fourth highest unemployment rate at 5.2%. Oregon, the third best place to work, ranks 15th worst for unemployment. New York ranks 12th worst. Washington State ranks 5th worst, and Colorado ranks among the worst 20. The lowest ranking states on the Oxfam list of wage policies, worker protections, and rights to organize have some of the country's highest employment rates. And Colorado has higher unemployment than Oxfam's 10 worst states, except for Texas, which tops the country in foreign and domestic workforce migration and has no net immigration. If establishing best places to work helps society, then stop at nothing. Don't set minimum wage at $14.42. Raise the lowest wages to $50 to $100 or more and become the best state in which to work. As for the jobs this will kill, no big political downside. That's because, aside from those who read jobs reports, few pay attention to the work that disappears or fails to materialize. As seen in Colorado, excessive workforce regulation kills jobs. Our trajectory, 72,700 fewer than wished for, says it all. Suffocating regulations help a fortunate few while causing hell for those who need work and cannot find it. Next up, a guest editorial. It says GOP's Williams used lawfare to duck accountability, as Jimmy Singenberger writes. If you're going to drag your party's dirty laundry into the courtroom, a good start might be to tell the truth and have a real case to boot. Alas, Colorado Republican Party Chairman Dave Williams learned this lesson the hard way when Arapahoe County Judge Thomas Henderson shredded his case right before his very eyes. At first, Williams was popping champagne when Henderson slapped a restraining order on a pesky pair of Republican rebels, Todd Watkins and Nancy Pelosi, hating their plans to oust Williams and his sidekicks. But days later, that same judge threw out a bid for a permanent injunction. Williams' allies insisted it wasn't a defeat, just a jurisdiction thing having nothing to do with the merits. Spoiler alert, that's not what really happened. Ever since Williams jumped into a congressional primary while clinging to his chairmanship like a lifeboat, a mutiny has been brewing within the Colorado GOP. Things heated up fast. Williams sent out wildly offensive anti-Pride Month email and used the state party swanky mailing discount to funnel $60,000 for his campaign. He even got scolded by Trump's campaign chairman for siphoning money off Trump's hush money verdict, and the Republican National Committee isn't sending a penny to Colorado's GOP. No wonder the insurgents are storming the castle. When a quarter of the Colorado Republican Committee petitioned for Williams to call a meeting to consider his removal back in June, he had 10 days to make it happen. He didn't. Instead, Vice Chair Hope Shepelman set a meeting for July 19th. Her plan was to start the meeting and immediately recess for August 31st, with vague promises of discussing Williams' potential ouster at that time. Shepelman's meeting notice didn't even mention removing Williams, and only Williams could unilaterally call the meeting. So, Watkins stepped up, scheduling a July 27th meeting to oust Williams, Shepelman and Secretary Anna Ferguson, reminiscent of a recent near-identical GOP shakeup in Michigan. Then came another twist. In early July, the Colorado GOP's Executive Committee, XCOM, declared Watkins' meeting improper and illegal, claiming he didn't prove sufficient member support. They canceled Shepelman's meeting, too. Here's the catch. The XCOM admitted there's no clear rule on verifying member support, even calling for fair and reasonable procedures to be developed. So, how do you cancel a meeting because of a rule that doesn't exist? On July the 19th, Shepelman gathered a few Colorado Republican Committee members on a Bayfield bike path where they found shelter from the rain and met under a bridge for less than 5 minutes. Let's be real. This was a kind of skit Saturday Night Live dreams of, except it actually happened. Because if you're desperate to get your way, who needs a quorum when you've got a clipboard and a raincoat? This isn't Shepelman's first rodeo with embarrassment either. In June, she shared a Democrat's attack ad against Republican Jeff Hurd, now the GOP's nominee, in the 3rd congressional district primary, even removing the legal disclaimer. When she got caught, instead of saying, oops, like everyone else, she reported it and proudly announced she had shared an ad paid for by Adam Frisch. You can't make this stuff up, but you sure can double down on it. Undeterred and on a solid ground, Watkins pressed ahead. Almost every GOP congressional candidate endorsed the rebellion. But Williams and his acolytes were determined to thwart the grassroots insurrection at all costs. They turned to the courts in hopes a judicial activist would throw them a lifeline. After failing to secure a permanent injunction in time, Williams scrambled for a temporary restraining order to stop Watkins' July 27th meeting. The order arrived the day before, leaving Watkins and Pelosi to no time to respond. The meeting was postponed. After hearing the case, Henderson tossed the temporary restraining order, citing lack of jurisdiction. Then, last Friday, the final legal death nail came to Williams' lawfare when Henderson dismissed his request for a permanent injunction, clearing the way for Saturday's meeting. Henderson made it clear the court has zero jurisdiction over such internal party disputes, but it goes deeper than that. Williams failed to carry his burden of the proof, Anderson wrote, rebuking him for misrepresenting the party's bylaws and the facts to the court. Henderson pointed out that while the XCOM can make decisions, it is subject to review by the Colorado Republican Committee. But that never happened because Williams rushed to court. In short, Williams tried to pull a fast one on the judge, presenting the XCOM's decisions as final. Except, as Henderson noted, the XCOM's decision admitted that any unhappy party like Watkins could appeal to the Colorado Republican Committee. The court's ruling wasn't some mere technicality over jurisdiction. Henderson originally bought Williams' story, mistakenly trusting his claims were legit and granting the restraining order. It became clear Williams had played fast and loose with the truth. Now, with Colorado Republican Committee members assembling, will they muster the numbers needed to give Williams the boot? Will Shepelman's competing Labor Day weekend meeting get a quorum? The saga is an example of using lawfare to avoid accountability, revealing yet another reason Williams and his minions should go. Jimmy Sennenberger is an investigative journalist, public speaker, and longtime local talk radio host. You may reach Jimmy for his opinions online at Jimmy Singer, that's S-E-N-G-E-R, or excuse me, Jimmy Singen, S-E-N-G-E-N-B-E-R-G-E-R.com, or on X at formerly Twitter at SenJenner. Turning to the letters to the editor, one's entitled Ongoing Overdose Crisis. As International Overdose Awareness Day approaches on August 31, it's crucial to address the overdose crisis that continues to ravage our community. Last year, over 100,000 lives were lost to overdose in the U.S., a staggering number that reflects a growing public health emergency. These individuals were more than just statistics. They were cherished members of our community, each with their own story and potential. At Safe Side Recovery, where I work as a peer recovery coach, we see firsthand how the overdose crisis disproportionately affects the homeless population in Denver. Our organization provides critical services such as housing assistance, recovery resources, job readiness, judicial advocacy, mental health support, and sober living. Unfortunately, the homeless community remains one of the most underserved, facing numerous barriers to accessing the help they need. Harm reduction strategies, such as providing naloxone and creating supervised consumption sites, are essential in saving lives, particularly among those with limited access to health care. Education is equally vital, ensuring that everyone, especially those most vulnerable, is equipped with the knowledge to prevent overdoses. Finally, it's imperative that we reduce the stigma surrounding addiction, particularly for those experiencing homelessness. Addiction is a disease, not a choice, and those who struggle with it deserve our empathy, not judgment. On this International Overdose Awareness Day, I urge our community to support harm reduction, advocate for education, and fight against stigma, particularly for our most vulnerable people. Together, we can make a difference. And that letter came from Anastasia Krususki from Englewood. Thank you for joining us for the Colorado Springs Gazette. It's read by Raymond Wallander.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.